Namaskaram. My name is Nayad. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come, follow me for a breakfast you will never forget. Namaste. Because you are going to make an incredible masala dosa under the watchful eye of my mom.
Kya baat hai, mom?
Each home adds their special touches. But not everyone gets to join in a traditional family meal. You will if you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com. And don't just travel, explore.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, buddy. Welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. The world watched in fascinated horror as the US Capitol was stormed by protesters this week. I really want to address this on the podcast, and I couldn't be happier to have an American on the podcast today for the first time on this pod, whose name has to remain a secret. He is a serving military officer. He has a huge following on social media under the name Angry Staff Officer. He is, as everybody knows who follows him online, he's a brilliant historian. He's a fascinating source of information about the US military, US history, and Star Wars. He's obsessed with Star Wars. He and I have been communicating over the years. We've become firm friends, and this was the first time that we've been able to meet, albeit via the internet, thousands of miles apart. I asked him about the history of insurrection in the US. And he wanted to share with me one very particular moment of insurrectionary history that occurred in Maine at the end of the 19th century, involving one of the most remarkable soldiers, scholars, and statesmen in US history. This is a rambling chat recorded late at night as the events in Washington, D.C. unfolded. If you wish to watch history documentaries alongside listening to podcasts, please do so at historyhit.tv. It's our new digital history channel. It's like Netflix for history. We've got hundreds of hours of documentaries on there, the world's best historians, dealing with history from the Iron Age right up until the present day. We've got a special introductory offer on at the moment. If you use the code January at checkout, you get a month for free. You can check it out all for free, and then you get 80% off your next 3 months of subscription. That's 80%. So you're getting 4 months for just a few cents, a few pence, a few pfennigs, if those are still in use anywhere in the world, every month. So please do go and check that out. That takes us through to post-vaccine, everyone. We can get back outside. We can celebrate. We can hug. In the meantime, everyone, please enjoy this interview with the anonymous but very brilliant Angry Staff Officer. Hey, buddy, it's great to have you finally on the show.
It is absolutely terrific to be here.
We've been messaging for so many years. We've been in touch. We've been friends for years, but we haven't talked before. I'm kind of nervous now. We're actually finally talking.
I like to call this the great Anglo-American bromance, I think is the most accurate way to portray this. And likewise, I feel like I'm speaking with a legend, and I'm not sure, should I be standing at attention? I don't know. So I'll just have another drink of a gin and tonic.
Well, I don't know, more appropriate. I think you should be citing artillery batteries with lethal effectiveness somewhere north of Albany. So, dude, you know, we were in close contact as we watched the assault on the Capitol. I can only imagine what was going through your head as an American, as a citizen, as a serving soldier, and as someone steeped in American history. What was going through your head, and also what bits of history have you been reaching for in the last days and hours?
Well, I think, like most people, I was obviously shocked. You know, you see the Capitol building, you visit it, standing outside, I assume you've stood outside in that building. It's such an imposing edifice. It is a very literal translation of U.S. power, of U.S. dignity of and just sort of this awe-inspiring building. I mean, it is very much in the way of the old cathedrals. Of you go in and go, oh, wow. and it inspires you to, at least for me, whenever I visit, it's just this space of, you know, I should be a better American. I should be, you know, I should be a more virtuous citizen in the lines as some of the founders thought about virtue. And so, of course, seeing that space violated, overturned, broken into, my first reactions were very visceral, lots of anger, sadness, grief, shock. And then as I sort of, I've been processing through it all, and I go, all right, we are a hopeful nation. We are a nation of, you know, those who overcome. And so as I sort of think about that, I go, you know, obviously, as you say, we look back in time for those anchor moments, for those anchor points in history. So that way we kind of feel like we have something to hold on to, something to guide by. And there's, goodness, there's no shortage of insurrections in American history. we'd barely gotten away from the lovely British, your folks, before we'd then decided to turn on ourselves with a couple different rebellions, you know, the Whiskey Rebellion and several others, usually small farmers protesting against what they saw was an overreach of government power. Those drove us from the Articles of Confederation, a flawed, weak document, really, that was just too much compromise and no teeth, to the Constitution, developed in 1787, which is a remarkable document. And so we've had these moments that have driven us and shaped us. Of course, our largest insurrection was the Civil War, which resulted in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments that began to slowly move away from the horrors of slavery and what we'd done as a nation to keep people enslaved. But there's so much caught up in that. There's so much emotion in that. And honestly, my first thoughts were to someone who I sort of, I don't know, I've gone to him for sort of guidance, for historical guidance, ever since I think I saw the movie Gettysburg when I was 9 or 10, and the great portrayal of by Jeff Daniels of Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. His father wanted him in the military. His mother wanted him a minister. He ends up becoming a professor of rhetoric and revealed religions at Bowdoin College in Maine. For those who aren't familiar of what the state of Maine is, it's a place that's north of Massachusetts and south of Canada, and is not either of them, but is often confused for both. But he born in 1828, and remarkable figure. He learned seven. He could speak seven languages. One of which was Aramaic, which is shocking, to say the least. Hebrew, Aramaic, so he's quite fluent in the ancient languages. Not the person that you would consider to be a future war hero, but when war does come, and he requests a leave of absence from Bowdoin College to go off and fight, and they say, no, you're a professor of religion and rhetoric, man. What are you doing? You can't do that. And so he puts in a request to go on a sabbatical to Europe, and they grant it, and then he goes off and enlists in the U.S. Army, becomes lieutenant colonel of the 20th Maine Regiment, and just a year or so later, during the fateful Battle of Gettysburg, he and the 20th Maine Infantry are posted on the extreme left flank of the U.S. line, attacked by two enemy regiments, outnumbered, outgunned, eventually runs out of ammunition, and makes a very fateful decision. This professor turned combat leader decides, you know, he's got a couple options at hand. One is, you know, retreat. That would seem to be the thing that would make sense. The other, stay and sort of gradually die in place. That doesn't make sense. And then the one that makes sort of least sense, but also sort of makes a crazy amount of sense, is to attack. And which that's what he does. Now, there's a lot of debate on just exactly how study that was, but at the end of the day, he orders an assault. They sweep down the hill with bayonets only, driving the enemy before them, capturing many prisoners, saving that portion of the Union line, and possibly saving the U.S. Army that day, and possibly the United States. Who knows?
Well, Chamberlain gets high praise from you. I mean, he's surely one of the few infantrymen that this exacting engineer regularly praises on social media.
I mean, he does, and he gets the Medal of Honor for this later in life. But then this remarkable man, he was leading his he gets promoted. He has brigade command at the Siege of Petersburg in 1864. And he's making the assault. He gets hit. Now, and I know you know this, but, you know, if you are anywhere really before the early 1900s, if you're gut shot, your chances are not good. And so he was shot through the thigh, groin, and intestines, and held himself up on his sword until his brigade had passed, so that way his men would not see him fall. Finally did fall. Was given up essentially for dead because, well, yeah, I mean, there's so many infections and in such a bad time. And it's only because his brother and the regimental surgeon intervened, and the regimental surgeon performed sort of exploratory surgery on the guy, an experimental surgery, and were able to patch him up. And within about 4 months, which is incredible, he's back leading troops again to the end of the war. But that isn't why I thought of him. I mean, I always think of him because who can't admire that type of courage? But he arrives home to Maine. He's quite a hero. He is governor of Maine for 4 terms. He is president of Bowdoin College. By 1880, he's in his 50s. And this is where my mind went as I saw people storming the steps of the Capitol. There's this moment. It's the election of 1880 in Maine, and very contested. The incumbent governor claims irregularities at the polls and refuses to vacate office. The incoming governor, the one who won the vote, protests. The state senate, the senators get involved, and everybody sort of appeals to Chamberlain. Now, at this time, he's a major general in the state militia. It's an honorary title because of the man that he was, but it does mean he's the commanding general of the militia. And so both sides are saying, hey, you know, we need the militia to come in here and settle this, because both sides are also arming. The incumbents' supporters are armed and inside the state house. Now, there are many moments across American history where this has sort of happened, and the armed groups have fought it out, and there has been bloodshed. Chamberlain arrived on the scene, and no one could have blamed him if he called up the state militia, secured the area, basically sort of put everything into martial law, as things were really verging on a civil war. It was that close. But he arrived, and he elected to not call up the militia. He said, whoever first says take arms has a fearful responsibility on him, and I don't mean it shall be me who does that. And which is just such a perceptive and brave thing to say, not resorting to that draw of power. And he manages to convince, again, this is what happens when you have a guy who he's been a professor of rhetoric. That means using words to get people to do things, you know? And so he convinces them to the governor and his supporters to vacate the state house. And for 12 days, he holds a vigil there alone. He does have the Capitol Police are nearby, and he does have his son actually go and fetch his Civil War pistols for him just in case. But there are threats on his life. Both sides attempt to bribe him, saying, hey, choose me and I will, you know, we'll make you the senator. He resists. He says remains firm, saying, my main object is to keep the peace and to give opportunity for the laws to be fairly executed. He was waiting for the state Supreme Court to make a decision, to, you know, to carry out the laws of the land. And it's sort of at the height of this crisis that a mob assembles in front of the state house, angry, furious, an aide rushes in to tell Chamberlain that there are men outside who want him dead, who are calling for his death. This is a war hero. This man is one of the greatest heroes that the state has ever had, and here there are people calling for his death. And there are people in the newspapers who are riling citizens up on both sides, saying, you know, he has to go. He is stopping the cause of justice. And there's this amazing, incredible moment, and I would love to see it depicted on film, although I don't know if you could do it justice, where Chamberlain walks out, he paces down the steps of the state house, and he looks at this assembled group, somewhere between 50 and 100 men. And he says this: "Men, you wish to kill me, I hear. Killing is no new thing to me. I have offered myself to be killed many times, when I no more deserved it than I do now. Some of you, I think, have been with me in those days. You understand what you want, do you? I am here to preserve the peace and honor of this state until the rightful government is seated, whichever it may be. It is not for me to say, but it is for me to see that the laws of this state are put into effect without fraud, without force, but with calm thought and purpose. I am here for that, and I shall do it. And if anyone wants to kill me for it, here I am. Let him kill." What do you say to that? You're in that position. What amount of shame must you feel when he says that? Is all I can think. And this is what happens: is a man jumps from the mob, interposes himself between Chamberlain and the mob, and says, "By God, old general, the first man that dares to lay a hand on you, I'll kill him on the spot." And that sort of settles it. The mob shamefacedly walks away. And after this 12 days of sort of vigil, the state Supreme Court makes their decision. The laws of land are carried out, and Chamberlain is allowed to go home. And his reputation does suffer from it, because there are many who believe that he was interposing. But looking back on that, the force of character and moral courage and physical courage is stunning to me, and something that it struck me as I saw those crowds on the Capitol steps going, "What? There has to be another way. There has to be. Where's the moral courage? Where is that we look back at as Americans in these moments of history? Those individuals who step forward in times of crises." And I think it's hanging on to that hope that, hey, you know, things have been bad. But we can bring something good out of this.
You're listening to me talking to one of the most famous sappers on the internet, Angry Staff Officer. More coming up after this.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, I'm looking for answers to the big questions about every aspect of life in the early modern period. Like, how did the memory of Anne Boleyn continue to influence the court of her daughter, Elizabeth I? How were fairies brought to life on the Elizabethan stage? And how did the arrival of male-only doctors threaten the lives of women? In other words, not just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Twice a week, every week. Subscribe now and follow me on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Yeah, I mean, it's physical courage, isn't it? But it's also married to such an astute sense of what America is. You know, in the rest of the world, particularly back in the 19th century, it's the guys with the guns that rule. It's the guys with the holy book. It's the guys with the lineage who trace their family line back to the murky Middle Ages. But in America, they were trying to do something different. There was a Republican project, and there still is. But the events of this week and the events of, you know, the events you described with Chamberlain, I mean, it's difficult. It's a really difficult thing.
It is, yes. That's the understatement. That's the understatement of the year, Dan. It is so difficult, and God, I mean, that's 1880. I mean, just 4 years prior, the United States fell to one of the gravest errors that I think the country has ever made, other than allowing slavery to persist past the founding and the Constitution. Because slavery was always, the great sin of the nation. You know, John Brown said it. He said, "This is the great sin, and it can only be paid for by blood." And there's another insurrection, ignited the nation further. A bleed over from Bleeding Kansas, the crisis that was happening in the Kansas territories for whether it was going to be a free state, a free soil, or another home for chattel slavery. I think a lot of people don't realize, they just think sort of John Brown went nuts and started killing people. I mean, the guy had members of his family killed for standing up for a free state. He watched other free staters get killed around him. And yes, then he went and executed people with broadswords. It's definitely a different story than I think a lot of people are taught. There are significant amounts of violence. But in 1876, you have this horrible betrayal of the 4 years that were the Civil War. The Republican Party makes a deal to win the White House, essentially, electing Rutherford B. Hayes on the condition that Reconstruction ends in the South. And Reconstruction is the most misunderstood, I think, period in American history, because what you have is, for the very first time, you've got multiracial assemblies. You have multiracial congressmen and legislators, and all of a sudden this whole segment of people are experiencing what the Declaration of Independence says, that all men are created equal. And it's this heady time, this exciting time, that gets undermined from within by white supremacy through terrorism with the KKK, the rise of the KKK. But the KKK was not the only one. There were multiple organizations. There were the Red Shirts in South Carolina. There were these sort of paramilitary organizations that would clash with the state militia, many of whom were African-American, fully African-American militias, representatives of the state government. And there was this open fighting and the clashing with federal troops. A lot of people don't know, you hear 7th Cavalry and you think, George Armstrong and Custer and poor decision-making. There was a whole battalion of the 7th Cavalry that was garrisoned in the South doing counterinsurgency operations against these insurgents during Reconstruction. And in 1876, this was all undermined through continued violence, through voter suppression on a massive scale. And all of that eventually came to a head in 1876. Reconstruction was ended. The federal troops were pulled out. And it would be, I believe, I think 1898 was when the North Carolina legislature sort of finally fell to the white supremacists, which eventually became sort of the Jim Crow era, as we call it, this tacit alliance between between whites to say, hey, yep, we'll keep the status quo because it's good for everybody, but you know, we're just not going to talk about what happens with race, and that's a really horrible thing, and we are still trying to recover from that, I think.
Yeah, listening to you talk about Chamberlain, I'm reminded of about the founders' sort of obsession with Republican virtue, and I sometimes think that Republican virtue was a bit of a catch-all term when they couldn't work out a particular piece of the Constitution. They just thought Republican virtue would kind of plug the gap. They made it perhaps do a little too much hard work, because it does strike me that despite the panoply of legal architecture that we've talked about, it still does come down to officials like the Secretary of State in Georgia recently, officials behaving in the public interest.
It does. And we have to sort of take the founders with a grain of salt, because I think I pointed it out on Twitter, but when we say the founders, that's somewhere around 250 different people, because you have the people who crafted the Declaration, the people who crafted the Articles of Confederation, which, although flawed, they were our first sort of form of government. And then you have the framers of the Constitution. None of these people got along with each other, I might add. The Constitution, I mean, all you have to do is look at the Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers in American history as a point of going, oh, wow, yeah, now there was a massive dissension there. Big piece of it was over slavery, but a big piece of it was the role of government. And I think yesterday a lot of us were really thinking of that moment where in 1787, at the conclusion of the Constitutional Convention, when they finally come to a compromise, they argued over everything, Dan. The size of an army. You'd think that would sort of be free of debate. Thanks to the Redcoats and the American populace had a very strong distrust of a standing army. But didn't Britain had a pretty strong distrust of a standing army? So I feel like that was an inherited quality. There's the amazing arguments. George Washington was the president of the proceedings, and he just sort of sat there in his chair and listened, and probably inwardly going, can I be in Valley Forge again? Can we just fight the British again? It'll be so much easier. Listening to the wrangling on and on, and Elbridge Gerry, who's this crotchety guy from Massachusetts, is talking about how we should limit the size of the army to, no more than 3,000, in the Constitution. And finally, Washington stirs in his chair, this august presence, and he makes this grumbling aside of saying, well, maybe we should also add in there that any invading army be limited to 3,000. just this monumental shade being thrown by this guy. But you are right. There is this idea that it is the individual. And I think it's a big conflict, right, in government. What's the role of the individual? What's the role of the group? What's the social contract that we make? Depending on your view, whether you're sort of Lockean, Hobbesian, Rousseauian, whatever, but they all come down to this idea of a social contract, of this idea that we give up a certain individuality in order to be part of a society for mutual protection, common good, yada yada. But at the heart of it, none of that can work if the individuals are all incredibly selfish.
The word militia, which some people around the world have difficulty understanding, and it's used, I think, lazily particularly by foreign journalists. What is the difference between a gang of armed people, a mob, and a militia? Because it's not semantics, right? It's not point of view. It's actually it's legally defined.
Well, we get this from you guys. So, and I get in arguments with people about it all the time because, the National Guard, we continue on the militia heritage and tradition. And the members of the Florida National Guard say, well, we were the first because we were with the Spanish. I say, nope. Mm-mm. Wrong, different militia tradition. The militia in England and Spain are very different. It goes back to really the 13th century, I believe, in one of the numerous assizes. The idea that the role of the citizen to protect the state, but at the behest of the state. And so as the colonies developed, the British colonies in North America, they took on this tradition for mutual defense, for self-defense, and a very powerful idea that got embodied in sort of the American mythos. But after the founding, the Constitution, and then each state forming a constitution, it became embodied in law what the militia was. And the militia is the citizen soldier. It is those who are called up by the government, by the state or local government, to carry out the laws of the land. And this is fascinating. We can look at really at Lexington, the engagement at Lexington. When Captain John Parker mustered his company on Lexington Green, awaiting the arrival of the light companies and poor Major Pitcairn, he was doing so as a representative of the Lexington Committee for Public Safety, and which was a part of the Massachusetts Committee for Public Safety, or the Massachusetts body politic, the legislature, because the legislature had been dissolved by the Crown. He was assembled on Lexington Green. He was on the green. He was not on the road. And that is a very powerful image because it says, I am here as a representative of the town selectmen, of my elected government, to keep the peace. That's it, to keep the peace. I'm not here to start a war. I'm not here to be braggadocious. I'm here to keep the peace. He did not block the road to Concord. They could have just marched on by. But as it happened, there was a church in the way, the column got separated, light infantry went one way, Pitcairn went the other, lost command and control, somebody shot, and here we are. But that's sort of the militia tradition, as representatives of the civil elected body, that in most state constitutions state it that way. Who are the militia? They are, currently, they are the National Guard, the unorganized militia are usually specified as those people who are eligible for military service, who may be called up by the governor, by the elected civil authority, in the case of invasion, insurrection, yada, 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 zombie attack, whatever. But that's what it's not just somebody who says, I have decided I'm a militia, and therefore I am going to, declare war on something, or I don't agree with something, so therefore I'm going to deputize myself. No, it doesn't work that way. And the Constitution allots that power to the states as well. And then eventually through the development of federal and state law, and that's the important thing, this law continues to develop, it's codified as such as the militia is the National Guard or some other entity that the state may authorize, but it has to be at the state government level. So when a group of people gets together and they're armed and they say, hey, we're a militia, no, you are an armed mob. You are not called up by the governor. You are not even called up by your town council. you are aggrieved citizens who, really should use your First Amendment right to for your petition for redresses. So that's the critical difference, and no amount of gun totingness is going to change that.
I didn't realize enough the essential link between the militia at Lexington and Concord and the political entity that predates it, that had been established in Massachusetts, at the sort of legal authority.
It is. It absolutely is. And that's why the formation of, you could call it a rump government in the colony of Massachusetts, after the closing of the Port of Boston and dissolving the legislature, putting in just absolute authority to the governor, really through the crown, or parliament, because I always say that the Declaration of Independence is a breakup letter to King George, because everyone sort of was like, hey, look, parliament's mean, but the king wouldn't do this to us. He just wouldn't do this. And it was a sort of shock. These are the people who, in 1763, were drinking their heads off to the king. They loved him because, what a great moment to be part of the British Empire. And then it was 12 years later. But that's a topic for another time. But Yes, it is absolutely important that these are representatives of an elected body, of a representative body, who are carrying out the laws of the land, not some group that is out to immediately begin a military. They were there to keep the peace in Lexington, and had it's very interesting to think what would have happened had the Light Column just continued marching down to Concord, Parker, because Parker gave direct orders, do not fire, let them pass. We are just here to keep the peace.
Listen, buddy, listen, Sapper. Thank you very, very much, dude. Tell everyone how to find you and how they can engage with your work.
You can find me tweeting at PPT Sapper, or search for Angry Staff Officer, and then angrystaffofficer.com for the blog. And you can check out the podcast that I did with my co-host Aiden Dobkin for three seasons of War Stories, which are looking at the development of a couple different technologies and tactics throughout warfare over time, through the micro lens at the individual, sort of the nitty-gritty level, and then at the macro, at the larger sort of perspective. We had a lot of fun putting that together.
Thanks, buddy. Thanks for coming on the show.
This has been an absolute pleasure, Dan, and let's do it again soon.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for reaching the end of this podcast. Most of you are probably asleep, so I'm talking to your snoring forms. But anyone who's awake, it would be great if you could do me a quick favour. Head over to wherever you get your podcasts and rate it 5 stars. And then leave a nice glowing review. It makes a huge difference for some reason to how these podcasts do. Madness, I know, but them's the rules. Then we go further up the charts, more people listen to us, and everything will be awesome. So thank you so much. Now sleep well.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favor. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.